In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
Welcome to The Big Story. We have a crazy episode for you today, but first, a few words from a friend of ours here at Frequency Podcast Network who has a podcast I'd love you to listen to.
Hey, I'm City News reporter Shauna Hunt. I'm also the host of The Legal Podcast, and you'll want to check this out. Over 8 episodes, I'll introduce you to some of Canada's pot pioneers. I'll take a look at the history of cannabis and the effects it has on the brain. I'll also take you on a trip with the ganja yogis. And we will be talking about the billion-dollar business and how you can make some money. So listen to us on frequencypodcastnetwork.com. You can also subscribe to us on your favorite podcast app. Talk soon.
Imagine yourself as the proprietor of a small, family-owned restaurant. You've been serving locals and scraping by for nearly 70 years. You make some fries, you make some milkshakes, and you make a decent burger if you do say so yourself. You might imagine that life-changing success to you would sound something like this.
I'm Kevin Alexander, and I've been on a quest for the past year to find the best burger in America. And after 330 burgers in over 30 cities, I finally found it at Stanich's in Portland, Oregon.
And you would be half right anyway. Your life would definitely change. This is a story about food and the real people who make it. And like every other story these days, it's also about the internet, the lists we make on it, the choices we make based on those lists, and what the digital age can do to an analog business. And it's about where you should eat lunch today and how you should get that information. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Kevin Alexander is a national writer-at-large for Thrillist. He also has a book out next year called Burn the Ice, The American Culinary Revolution. Kevin, take me back to the beginning. Tell me about the very first time you walked into Stanich's. Describe it for me.
Yeah, I came directly from the airport, and my editor who lived in Portland and told me, you know, you've got to go to this place. It's this old school spot. He knew that was kind of my jam. And I walked in and it was like pennants on the wall, you know, those old school triangle pennants.
Yes.
For sports teams, and a couple of like old timer people sitting at the bar nursing beers and some sort of talk show sports on, and just like one guy behind the counter. And I sort of pulled up and sat at the counter, squeaky chair. And it took a little bit of time to take my order. You know, it was just sort of like people eyeing me. It's a very much a locals place, sort of everyone. It has that cheers effect of like everyone knows everyone. So who are you? Why are you here?
Why were you there?
Yeah. So I did something called Burger Quest, where I went around the country to 30 cities and tried 330 burgers in an effort to find the best burger in America. So that was, that's what I was doing at the time. So that is what brought me to Stanich's that day.
How was the burger?
I mean, the burger was fantastic. It was sort of thin. I like the kind of diner style, thin patty, oozy with American cheese. It had some sort of grilled onions that had been sitting in something for a long time. You know, everything about it, the makeup of the burger, the way that they built the burger, the red relish combining with the mayonnaise, combining with some sort of mustard.
Oh, man.
Created this. Yeah, yeah, right. And like, I just remember biting into it and having one of those sort of profound moments where you're just like, wow, okay, this is, I need to pay attention to what's happening here. And, you know, I knew I was going to eat like 9 other burgers that day, but I finished the whole thing, which I never do. So yeah, it was really a life-changing moment for me as far as burgers go.
And what happened when you sat down at the end of the quest to figure out what the best burger in America
is? Yeah. So I went back to Portland, tried it again, realized it was as good as I'd remembered. And then I named Stanich's as the number one burger in America. I put out a top 100 burgers. I tried 330, but I put out a top 100 burgers in America, and sitting at number one was Standage's.
Why were you traveling America to try to put together the best burger? Like, what's the purpose behind this project?
Yeah. So basically, I was tired of seeing a bunch of lists pervading the internet where you had no idea where they came from. Like, who was writing the list? Did they get the information off Yelp or from, you know, just cribbing stuff from local alt weeklies? Why was this happening? And so I pitched the idea of doing this and trying them all myself, because I felt like it's so rare that a single person is the one who does anything nationally. And that way the reader could follow along with my story, and I would explain the style of the burger I liked, and they could agree or disagree with that, but at least then they, you know, it would all be coming from the same person. So that was sort of the reason that I wanted it to be a list unlike a lot of them that were going around the internet at the time. So I felt really good about it. My editors felt good about it. We did a short video with Steve Stanich, the owner, where I named it, you know, the number one burger in the country. And he cried and said his parents would be so proud. And, you know, I walked away from it feeling good about myself.
What happened to Stanich's after the article came out?
So they had this onrush of people coming to the restaurant. And, you know, this is a family-run business, open since 1949. The people that worked there were mostly relatives. I had told them, you know, oh, you know, you might expect a little bit of a pickup, but let's be honest, I didn't expect all that many people to care that much. But it just went the other way. There was, you know, five-hour waits. And it just turned into this debacle where they ultimately ended up having to close down.
That's insane.
Yeah. I mean, and you know what? I don't want to take complete credit for sort of what happened with the closure. So basically what happened was I was just going about my time. I thought, okay, like, this is great. And then all of a sudden there was a story in The Oregonian by Michael Russell, who's the restaurant critic up in Portland. And it was about how Stan's just shut down. And in the story, he talks about how being named the best burger in America was the worst thing that ever happened to him. He talks about the five-hour wait and how the place got dirty and they couldn't get a burger to Tim McGraw, the country music singer. And that was how I found out about it. I found out about it through the newspaper, and I found out that it closed at the time. And I was working on a book, and so I wasn't able to sort of immediately react to it. But it made me feel really, really bad. And I knew that, you know, I eventually wanted to get to the bottom of what really happened. How responsible was I for the closing of Stanich's?
Right. Because it sounds obviously on the surface, these lists exist everywhere, all the time. And being chosen number one is the dream, right? And all small businesses would probably take it if you offered it to them. Did you figure out what happened?
Yes. Well, I mean, look, so basically what I realized, and I think it's important to distinguish between new restaurant lists. So like, say, the best new restaurant from Bon Appetit, the top 10, or lists that shine a light on old places, because there's any place that opens nowadays, and my editor called it, you know, an analog restaurant in the digital world, which I like, so I'm going to steal that. But these analog restaurants that have been open forever, they have a certain ecosystem, right? That's just
right.
In place. And when you mess with that, it's sort of like in Back to the Future, you know, when Michael J. Fox is like, starts, you know, I don't think he's dating his mom, but something is happening like
right.
That. And people start disappearing. Like, when you mess with that fragile ecosystem, you have no idea what will happen. And I think that's what happened with Stanich's. There were obviously things happening behind the scenes that I couldn't have known about. But what I did is sort of, I shined a light on a shaky foundation, and they, you know, they couldn't handle it anymore. And it really, it put a strain on the people working there. It put a strain on the relationships that the people who were working there had with each other. The tourists were upset because of the waits. The locals were upset because now they couldn't get a burger for a couple hours.
Right.
It just kind of, it turned into this, you know, bad thing. And I felt responsible for that.
When I read your story for The Thrillist, that was the thing that I think captivated me and captivated everybody else, is that, you know, man sets out to do great thing, accomplishes it, and it all goes wrong. Did you try to talk to them again?
I did. So as soon as I knew I was coming back from my book sabbatical, I called Steve Stanich. I had his cell phone number. I was, you know, I put it off as long as possible, basically. Yeah. I did not want to make that call. But yeah, I talked to him and he, you know, he was surprisingly open and he said, come up to Portland and I'll explain the whole thing. So I did. So I went up to Portland and I met with him in his office behind the restaurant. And, you know, we had an honest conversation where he basically released me from responsibility. But as he was releasing me from responsibility, he was explaining all of the things that had gone wrong, how people would leave expletive-laden voicemail messages for him, how the Yelp reviews, people were just saying terrible things.
Because they can't get a burger because the place is packed and everybody ends up with horrible service and the whole thing goes to hell.
Right, exactly. And he was basically like, you know, I don't care about those people, but I care about the locals that were affected that used to come in. And that hurts me that I'm not able to feed them. And so we had this, you know, this conversation and look, like, there were personal things that went on in his life that he asked me not to share that also played a part. So it wasn't, you know, so in that way, it wasn't just what I did, but because of what I did, those personal things, it sped up the process, or it sped up the demise of the restaurant, I guess is the best way I can put it. And it was just sad, man. Like, it's like, yeah. You know, aside from everything else, it was really depressing to talk to him. He took me into the restaurant. It was 9 months that they'd been closed, but he kept the ice machines and all this stuff on. He fixed the bathrooms. He wanted to open up and it was just, you know, he couldn't figure out how to put it together. And it really just broke my heart.
Will they ever go back to, is it even possible for them to go back to serving locals? Like, if they wait long enough, will that list go away?
Of course. I mean, I think so. I think the blessing and the curse of internet culture is everything is so sped up, right? So this whole thing happens and eventually people will move on to the next thing and they'll be able to kind of get back to the local side of it. But I think because this became this national story, it's even more difficult. But there are also, you know, Steve Stanich called me a few days ago.
Oh, yeah?
And I haven't told anyone this. This is breaking news.
We got a scoop.
Yeah, he called me a few days ago, and I, again, got nervous answering the phone. Wasn't sure what he was going to say. And he told me, like, ever since this story ran, people from his high school have been reaching out. All these locals have been reaching out. They're asking what they can do to help. You know, does he want to set up a GoFundMe? And it seems like he might be able to open in a small capacity. So I'm hopeful for him. I'm hopeful that something will work out, I guess, is all I really should say about that.
That's fair enough. I also wanted to talk to you because of what you wrote about lists, which even though I've lived in my city for 25 years now, and I think I know almost all the good restaurants in it, I still end up Googling, like, last weekend, I Googled best barbecue joints in Toronto because I felt like barbecue, and I picked one of them. Why do we do this?
Well, I mean, there's an interesting thing about our brains that the New Yorker had an article a few years ago about, that we have so much information coming at us at all times now, you know, so much information, and there's something satisfying about lists. There's something in our brains that when we see, it's like you're able to complete. And I mentioned the story. It's like why you don't write grocery paragraphs. You know, you write grocery lists because you know you can check them off. And there's something satisfying to knowing about the best things that are happening. So lists by themselves are great. And then because we constantly feel rushed now all the time,
yep,
we feel like we should only spend our time doing the best things, right? So why waste your time with like a shoddy barbecue joint when you can get the best barbecue joint in Toronto? So I think there's that, it's a little bit of human nature and a little bit of the way that brains work that why list culture is so pervasive. But on top of that, you know, social media has drawn that to a, you know, push that out to a bigger and bigger, more important factor in the way that we consume media.
If you could go back and do this again, would you still name the burger joints? And would you still just do it on your own, or would you be looking to, like, knowing what you know now, would you do it the same way?
I would do it in a different way. Because I'm thinking about this, because there's a chance that I'm going to be back on the road eating more burgers in the future.
Right.
You know, it's like, this is part of my job. I think that I now, armed with the knowledge that I have now, is I would have a real conversation with whoever. And I might ask them, do they want to be on this list? Do you want me to name you here? And because I feel like if you're celebrating a place, it shouldn't be like a hostile conversation. You know, you shouldn't be like, well, I'm going to name you the best, whether you like it or not. Like, that's not the point. So I feel like I would have a conversation with the place, make sure they understood. You know, that's kind of the good side about writing the story, is I can point them to something real, say, look, I just want to warn you that, like, these sort of things happen. And
if it blows up, you're going to have to be prepared.
Right. Like they're, you know, there are steps in place, because I've seen a lot of conversation around this, and people are like, well, why didn't they just hire more people? Why didn't they just, you know, like, there were a lot of like, this is free money coming for them. I don't understand. And I get that. But it's just also places that have been around for a long time. Like I said, when you have that sort of fragile ecosystem, you just don't understand all the factors that can affect the way that you maybe have run a business for 40 years. And so I think it's worth at least having a conversation, like an honest conversation with a place before I would put them on a list. Now, that's not to say, like, if it's a new place, I feel like they kind of understand. And you can just get
and they need it.
Yeah, exactly. And they're looking for that sort of a thing. Or if it's a place like this place, Raoul's, which was my number two burger in America, they have 12 burgers a night. You have to get the burger at the bar. When they're done with the burger, they're done. They couldn't care less about my list.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, especially after that story about Raoul's, is like the power of secrets. You know, I remember 15 years ago, before everything was searchable, you would have to ask a friend who had been to a city, or somebody you knew who'd spent time there. You know, I'm going to Barcelona next week. Where should I go for tapas? Or, you know, I'm going to New York City. Where am I going to have a pizza? I don't feel like anybody does that anymore. And would you share your secrets? Like, do you have a place that you don't want to tell people about? You don't want to write about?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I absolutely do. And I now, you know, it is more and more something that I would rather just keep to myself. I have places, especially around where I live in Northern California, that I'm like, this is my local and I'm good not blowing this up. But I think the sad thing about what you say is that, you know what you do when you ask someone about that stuff? You have a conversation with your friend. It's another excuse to check back in with someone that maybe you haven't talked to in a while. It's more and more human interaction. And I think one of the big, as we're discovering, that like all these things that we sort of thought were these utopian ideals 10, 15 years ago are actually not great for us. Like, it comes back down to human interaction. Call up your buddy and ask him about the best ramen place in San Jose, or like, you know, the best poutine in Montreal. Like,
right. And he will care.
Phone a friend.
He will care about your experience and your end result. Whereas a lot of these lists that I Google and click on the first thing, like that's somebody, I know it. That's somebody in a content farm, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, that's the frustrating thing too, because it's like, we've gotten so cynical about it. When we put together lists at Thrillist, I was really proud from a national perspective, is that we used to have editors in like 30 cities. And so I could reach a real person and say, well, what's your recommendation? You're the city editor.
Right.
Here.
You're starting from somewhere real.
Yeah, exactly. So when we put together national lists originally, I was like, okay, this is good. But it didn't matter once we put it online, especially if you get something through Facebook or social media, because people don't care where it came from. They're only So it just became this, oh, this is clickbait. I don't know when the audience just turned super cynical and hostile. And I know it's gotten worse in the last couple years for obvious reasons, but it just turned sad. You know, it's like everyone is so cynical and so quick to like look for a problem with something rather than a good thing about it. But I don't blame them, because lists are everywhere. And a lot of them are cynically built in content farms, and It's a tough world out here in the online media business, but, you know, I'm trying to do the best I can.
Well, you told a real story, so thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Kevin Alexander, National Writer-at-Large for Thrillist, author of the upcoming Burn the Ice, The American Culinary Revolution. That was The Big Story. For more from us, visit us at thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can find The Legal Podcast as well as all of our brother and sister shows at frequencypodcastnetwork.com. You can also hit up The Big Story on social media at Big Story Podcast, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. And of course, all these shows are everywhere you get podcasts, including Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, Google, Pocket Casts, and I could go on and on. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Claire Brassard is our lead producer. Ryan Clark is our associate producer. And Megan Coley is our associate editor and social media champion. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll talk on Monday.
Hi there. I'm Gavin Crawford. I'm a writer, an actor, and a comedian. And for the last 8 or 9 years, I have been navigating life with my mother's increasing dementia. Has it been sad? Yeah. Has it been funny? Also, yeah. That's what my brand new podcast series, Let's Not Be Kidding, is about. It's the true story of my life as a comedian, my mom, and dementia. Let's Not Be Kidding, with me, Gavin Crawford. A new 7-part series from CBC Podcasts, available now.